Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to this. It is the Egg Chasers Rugby Podcast, a podcast about rugby. It doesn't take itself or the game too seriously. Now, boys, this is our second attempt at doing this, and I've ruined it twice now because I should have said something completely different, but it's just muscle memory. We were told by a esteemed listener of the podcast that we should be doing it differently.
So, who is this esteemed listener, and what did they say?
They said, well, I'm not. Are we not saying who the esteemed listener is, Tim?
Well, I mean, it might offend their colleagues from another grassroots podcast to know that they are so engaged in our podcast that they make these kind of suggestions.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, we're working on it. But for me, it's muscle memory. And I'm sorry because, in 2.5 minutes, just like England, I let everybody down then.
the suggestion was that, Phil, let's workshop this. The suggestion was from this esteemed journalist from a very esteemed publication who have a grassroots podcast of their own, but which this esteemed journalist is a big fan, long-term fan and friend of ours. The suggestion was that we should start the podcast with Let the Boys Play and end the podcast with Let the Boys End, as JB accidentally said on the last episode.
Is that what that meant? Yes, of course it is. Of course it is. Very good. I enjoy that.
I do like Let the Boys End. Yeah, Let the Boys End is good. But I quite like our intro. It's been going for 11 years now?
11th year.
Yeah, 11th year.
It's not broken.
It's the 11th year. Yeah.
Well, do you think we sound like...
And you've started with the little... England jibe already. It hurts too much.
Well, I guess we should first of all tell everyone where they can contact us, which is on Gmail, because that has blown up. What did we get, like 30 odd emails last night or something ridiculous? So that's contact eggchasers@gmail.com. I have read every one of them, and they kind of are, well, most of them are of the same vein, just absolutely gutted. So that is the best way to find us. Don't bother with Twitter, don't bother with Facebook, do that, and also download us on...
That's why you drank all the emails. You were just drinking up the salty tears of England fans.
Filled up several cups.
You're loving this, aren't you, JB?
No, I am genuinely a little bit torn, because I want England to go out, because I don't want the RFU to say they've done a great job, because they haven't. But on the other hand, I know how painful it is for all my friends that love England, and all the players that I respect so much, and they work so hard for this. So it's not like the classic Welshman going, yeah, good, they've gone, or anything like that. Far from it. I just don't want English rugby to die, and I think this gives cover for the RFU to kill it.
I kind of understand your conflicted viewpoint. Although you are the least Welshman at the moment.
I'm North Walian, I'm not Welsh.
But I remember a time where you genuinely always wanted Wales to win. A long, long time ago. Now, you want France to win. You want South Africa to win. You want New Zealand to lose. England to lose. All of those outcomes are a greater priority in your mind than Wales winning.
Yeah, yes. Wales mean nothing to me as a rugby entity. I'm from North Wales, right? So... what do they have to say to me? I mean, they've said nothing to me my entire life except for a little bit of RGC action, and I'm not really doing much with that at the moment either, are they? So, I mean, best of luck to them, but you know, the South Walian team, the team that represents South Wales did very, very well in the World Cup, and they should be proud of themselves, but I don't care what they do.
Well, I'll just chip in and say you can also find JB packing heat on Instagram. You can find me in France, although I'm currently in the home of the TMO shipping container. I'm in Greece currently. I've gone... I didn't stay in a hotel last night. I went straight from the Stade de France on the... I missed the last metro. I was devastated. So I had to get a night bus from the north of Paris to the south to Orly. Rather, I wasn't going to spend like 70 euros on a taxi. And especially as I had... I was doing nothing but twiddling my thumbs until a 7:30 flight to Kalamata. So I'm now in Greece.
Go
back to Paris later this week. I know.
Wow.
But honestly, lads, the number of people... You get a glimpse of it from like 8-minute YouTube videos. Even in one 8-minute YouTube video last night, I must have been stopped about 7 times, like one a minute. And it was like that all night with people going, love the pod, love the pod, love the pod, like everywhere I went.
Awesome.
Amazing.
Absolutely awesome.
It was bonkers. So lots of people said hello to you, lads.
Oh, excellent.
Fantastic. And that's, we had perhaps not quite as frequent as that, but we had experienced a little bit like that in Japan.
Yeah, it was amazing.
4 years ago. Absolutely particularly amazing. The England games that we went to see.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the England game.
Yeah, because can we just establish, we don't really need to talk about New Zealand, Argentina. If Argentina can't be bothered to turn up, why should we be bothered to talk about the game they're involved in?
Well, we'll come back to that in a minute.
Yeah, maybe, Tim, because I know you're obviously 2 hours ahead and you're on Greek time. But maybe JB and I will touch on it a little bit. I don't think we'll go anywhere near the depth, but it is the second priority of tonight. The first priority being, let's talk about that England-South Africa game, the whole thing.
Well, I'll let you kick it off, Phil, because I watched this and I was kind of an interested observer, but I didn't watch it with the passion and the intent that you would have. So you go for it.
So I watched this on my own, and I was, it's funny. We always say that it's the hope that kills you.
Yeah.
Because if you asked me a week ago, or indeed you listened to the pod from a week ago, and I was saying, South Africa by 30, play this game 100 times, South Africa comfortably win 90 of them, and then 10 become interesting, of which only really 5, England can do anything. But throughout the week, I got more and more confident. I don't know, maybe not confident, but I was considering more and more the different angles that could take England to close to winning it. And I would say I certainly wasn't confident going into it, but I thought we had a chance.
Yeah.
And then I thought maybe 75-25 or 70-30, that kind of thing, going into it. And then the conditions and the way that England started playing, the physicality in the front in defence, the execution of the box kicking and the crossfield kicking, the solidity of the back three and indeed the half backs under the high balls. And it's the hope that kills you, because all of those things for the first 50 minutes, I think, 55 minutes, led to England being on top of the game and led to that 9-point lead. And then it started to fall apart.
They might... Well, Tim, do you want to jump in with anything there?
I think Phil's just summarised the game. I would only build on top of it and say, I remember saying to the chap next to me, who was an Irish journalist, I remember he was just full of praise, like, wow. He just kept saying, wow, wow, wow. And I just turned to him and said, that is the perfect... It was at 17 minutes, and I think we were 6-0 up at that point. I'm not sure. But I just said,
yeah,
this is perfect. And I mean that sincerely. We'd wrecked their line out. We were attacking their breakdown. We were smashing them in the tackle, in the collisions. We were box kicking beautifully, kicking to compete. Everything was, it was like the perfect England opening 20 minutes. And whilst there were, you know, moments that weren't quite as perfect, it was pretty much bang on the money for, like Phil said, and I'll let you continue this, Phil, 55 minutes. Like, to the point that Eben Etzebeth got the shepherd's crook.
Oh, well, we need to talk about those substitutions in a minute. But, yeah, I mean, you spoke about how would England go about trying to beat South Africa. Now, one of the ideas which we had was get rid of the hooker to attack the line-out. Well, they seem to have jumped that bit and just attacked the line-out. Mm. And that worked very, very well. I mean, really well. And I think Benambi, at the moment, I think Benambi might be player of the tournament. I think he has been, frankly, magical. But he really struggled.
Yeah, I think you're right on both counts. He's been superb because he's had so much pressure on his shoulders. But Marrow and Big Court and George Martin made life difficult,
didn't they, just
for them in the lineup?
I mean, you've got to remember, I say Benambi as if it's his fault. It's not. There are loads of things that go wrong. You know, they're reading jumpers. You don't know how they knew where to go. You know, and the likelihood is they're tracking jumpers and lifters rather than anything to do with, you know, overthrows or underthrows.
But even when England didn't directly compete and mess up the ball, the Maul defence was immense as well. They took that away from them, even when South Africa won the ball. The word that got used a lot about South Africa is they were rattled, and they absolutely were. I haven't seen for a long, long time, maybe ever in this guise under Razzie Erasmus and latterly Jack Nienaber, but I've never seen this South Africa team look scared, but they looked legitimately scared by what they were facing.
Yeah, and you know that feeling, don't you? You know that feeling from playing the game yourself. When you're a good team and you just things aren't going your way, and then for the first time in, you know, weeks and weeks, actually it is weeks, maybe months in South Africa's case, you just think, this isn't going our way. Like, what can we do to... And you just keep on making errors, and those errors compound. You know, it's no different in amateur rugby to professional rugby, that feeling of, oh my God, this is slipping away from us, and we feel a bit powerless.
But in South Africa's defence, they never gave up, and I think they always knew, because they've done it so many times, they always knew there would be a period in the game, particularly when they unleashed their bench, and Snyman and Oxenishe...
Ox was... ace.
In particular, they knew that they were going to have a period of dominance at the scrum, which leads to penalties. And so I think they always believed. And it's funny because I didn't have any money on the game, but I was looking at the odds because I was fascinated before the game to see that you could get sixes on England.
Yeah, which is what I got.
Which I thought were longer than they should be. But at no point, even with less than 15 minutes to go when England were 9 points up, at no point from what I saw were England ever favourites in the game. According to the bookies, yes.
Wow.
Which shows something about the history of this South African team. Now, that's English bookies as well.
Goodness me.
As an England fan... I never felt safe, comfortable, like you always knew it was coming.
Yeah.
And in that, if we just talk a bit more before we get into that last 30 minutes or 20 minutes, and we will talk about Ox, who was probably the player of the match, even though he played 25, 30 minutes.
He's great. But
some of the performances, I think if you were counting the best performers for, say, that first 50 minutes... I think you'd struggle to name a South African in them.
Yeah, you would.
I think you would. Freddie Stewart was amazing. I thought Elliot Daly was...
Well, to put it that way, was there, like, in terms of who got the better of their opposite man, that's an easy one to answer. There was not a single South African that was better than their opposite man.
Maybe Bongi and Benambi over Jamie George for the first 50 minutes.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Fair.
Other than that... even like Mal Herb and Kitsoff. Yeah, I'm not sure they did. I'm not sure any of the back row did. The halfbacks did not. England's centres were quiet, but so were South Africa's.
Mm.
The back three didn't. The second rows didn't. I thought maybe the best forward on the park for the first 50 minutes was George Martin.
I was about to say George Martin, yeah.
He was phenomenal. Some of the hits he put in, just time and time again.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. Here's the angle I would take as well, which is the Borthwick reign so far, for a coach of his quality and what he's already done, has been atrocious.
Well, pre-World Cup, atrocious. The games that have mattered in the World Cup...
One's gone well.
He's done enough.
The others... I'm not sure there's enough... quality opposition.
He'd won five games, and really, that's his job, isn't it?
Yeah,
let's be honest.
Yeah, but you know, would you look at those five games and go, okay, with the exception of Argentina, would you go, oh yeah, there's enough there, which I'm pretty sure they'll give South Africa. You just wouldn't know, would you?
Oh no,
there's no way to tell.
Yeah, but if you're judging how they're going to perform against South Africa against those five games, you'll judge badly, like as we did last week. But that's not the yeah. purpose of those games. The purpose of those games is win
yeah.
to get to the point of South Africa. So you can only say he fulfilled his role.
So I'm gonna say something now, right? Which sounds a bit naff. But I would say the Borthwick rain started last night,
And I don't necessarily disagree. Like I think that is it's the kind of performance that. Like he was asked this kind of question in post-match and he kind of shied away from making any statements. So we'll make them for him. But that is exactly the kind of performance to lay the foundations for the next 4 years.
Yeah.
It has to be.
If you're an England fan now, because you think about what was Leicester? Leicester was a team who could attack line-outs and attack from line-outs. The England line-out has not been good for a long time, which is weird for a man and coach of his quality. And in fairness to us, we have always said, you know, he is a good coach. Just wait. But the line-out was baffling to me because we know he is so good at the line-out and then the more. Well, finally we saw that. Finally. And then the kicking to compete. There was a lot of... I mean, I've been in the camp saying it was not working, but last night it did work. It did work.
And do you know what? And to think about what was Leicester Tigers' finest moment under Steve Borthwick, it was winning the Premiership final against Saracens, who did they start at nine in that game?
Richard Wigglesworth
because Steve Borthwick hatched a very specific plan to tactically match and overcome an incredible Saracens team. And that's why he specifically brought Richard Wigglesworth in. And fortunately, it's one of those occasions. I've said a lot of stuff which would be total rubbish, but there's a YouTube video which, as soon as England's team named, I was more bullish and more confident of England than I laid out, because it was absolutely obvious. And how so? I mean, I'm surprised South Africa didn't know, or maybe they did know what was coming, but it seemed like they didn't know what was coming. But as I think anyone who just gave it 2 seconds thought, looked at the team, saw George Martin, went, right, that's a defensive selection, as in
yep.
the biggest, best defender. They're not going to want the ball. They're going to give South Africa the ball all day long. Freddie Stewart was another part of that selection, and Joe Marler was to try and equalise the scrum. He is brilliant, Steve Borthwick, at tactically analysing teams and picking specific plans for it. And I think you're absolutely right. This is a little line in the sand that he can now build from.
Yeah. So encouraging, but ultimately not enough. Now,
and England never looked like scoring a try.
Yeah, yeah, and that is a worry, isn't it?
That's the most frustrating. Now, part of that was down to the fact that several times late on in the game, they got scrums, or at least two in South Africa's 22, and immediately conceded a penalty. Some of it, though, was down to fluffing lineouts earlier
Jamie
in the
George,
game.
He'll be haunted.
The
game was in that one line out, I reckon, on South Africa's 5 metre line. I reckon Jamie George doesn't screw that throw up, England win.
But there was a few. There was a not straight. There was the one where he completely fluffed it.
Yeah.
I mean, the line out.
Oh, yeah, that one too. It could have been any one of those. It doesn't do it. They win the game. Equally, you could say Freddie Stewart kicks long, not short.
I know.
And England win the game. I mean, but it never comes down to one single point of failure, as we always say.
What about this point of failure? You know what I'm going to say.
Go on.
Farrell's descent.
Now so I was fuming at Farrell during the game. I've rewatched it.
Yeah.
And I fully understand why Farrell did it. Because, first one.
Yeah.
So, what? If you remember, I had a bit of a rant a few weeks ago about the bunker.
Yep.
Because it's, one of the things I was trying to get across was, when you bring in, or you're supposed to bring in a higher level of certainty, you're held to a higher standard. And therefore, if you get something wrong, it's more obvious.
Yeah.
Like you're more frustrated when something goes wrong. And there's two things I'll mention in this game, one later, but one now, where Ben O'Keefe made a statement about his reality, the reality that he had seen,
okay,
that did not match up with reality.
Okay.
Yep. So this occurred, and it occurred twice in short succession that led to the Farrell descent. The first one was the penalty against Manu, where he said Manu rushed in, wasn't part of it, rushed in, pushed the opposition. And he said, no pushing after the whistle's gone. That was just wrong. Manu was stood next to Reinach, Because from that mall...
Oh, yeah, okay.
From that mall, Damien Deal... So this is a mall 20, 25 minutes, maybe 20 minutes into the first half. Line out on the right-hand side for South Africa in England's 22. They catch and drive. Creel and Dialandi were all in that mall. They were lined up. It was like a 12-man line out. So Manu was also in that mall. So when it collapsed and stopped, Manu was just stood next to Reinach. He put his arm around him and kind of cheered. The whistle has gone. Reinach pushes Manu. So Ben O'Keefe says, no pushing after the whistle. And Farrell's just trying to get across to him. It wasn't Manu who pushed after the whistle. It was Reinach.
But what's the real answer, Phil?
Well, the referee is always right.
Correct. And what should Farrell have said?
Well,
yes, sir.
And he did say yes.
No, hold on. Okay. I'll just stop that. Right, if that had been any other England player, I would totally agree with you, JB. He's the captain.
Well,
yeah.
He should know better.
So he did then bite his tongue and say, yes, sir.
Okay.
The same thing happens a few minutes later. It's the penalty against Alex Mitchell for sealing off. Reinach again. So the whistle's gone. Reinach again pushes after the whistle. So Ben O'Keefe says,
correct,
no pushing after the whistle. It's a penalty against you. And twice Ben O'Keefe's reality didn't match up with actual reality.
So, okay.
So that's where Farrell is trying to talk to the referee, not having a go, just trying to talk to him as a captain, and the penalty goes for dissent. So I think both of those... You're right.
I'll just jump in, Phil. I think O'Keefe lost his head on that and was totally wrong. And I actually think one of the things that has been rightly levelled against Owen Farrell, in fact, we've levelled it on this very podcast many times, is the manner of Farrell's communication with the referees doesn't endear him to the referee and isn't the best thing for the teams.
It's not,
actually,
is it?
And I've watched the game again. His communication with the referee, I think, honestly... That is the finest leadership last night ever seen from Owen Farrell. And his communication with the referee was absolutely outstanding. Honestly, watch it. I think Steve Borthwick said this after the game, and he was absolutely on the money. He led the team amazingly well.
Right, with hindsight, you can say because it ended up wrong.
So look,
but I think the wrongness was on.
Ben O'Keefe was wrong, and by that, and Owen Farrell's got to swallow that. And people that already hate Owen Farrell will use that as a stick to beat Owen Farrell with.
No. This isn't about people who already hate Owen Farrell, right? We're not having.
Let's hear JB. Explain this.
The people that hate Owen Farrell, the Owen Farrell haters in one camp, and then, of course, the Owen Farrell sycophants in the other camp, and, of course, the two will never meet.
Well, no, it's the people who hate Owen Farrell and then the people who are right.
Of course, yes, of course, it is the
correct.
It is the Israelis and the people that are right, or the Palestinians and the people that are right, depending on which side you're on, right?
Go on, JB.
Ben O'Keefe will not be the first referee to lose his head in a big game, and it happens frequently, maybe not as frequently as it used to do. But if you want excellent leadership of how you deal with a referee who was losing his head, look no further to another England player who trotted on about half-time in a World Cup final and said to the ref, look, sir, I know you're struggling with the scrum, which he was, just tell me what to do. I'll go backwards, I'll go forwards, or words to that effect. Jason Leonard. If the referee is losing his head, help him, right? That is the art of communication. It isn't say he led wonderfully and then got done for dissent, which then led to a penalty, which then led to your 1-point loss. That just isn't a thing. And
it didn't lead to the 1-point loss. If you want to go down that route, you could dissect the fact that Dion Farid did a double movement. He was clearly tackled, got back up, and ran towards the line in the immediate phase before RG Snaiben goes over the line.
But I'm not going to do that because there are a thousand different individual moments in that game.
And if you want to pick on one and say that was the reason for a defeat.
Yeah, here is the thing, though, right?
Bullshit.
Owen Farrell can do nothing about Dion Farid. Owen Farrell can do everything about Owen Farrell. That is the difference.
Yes, and he was incredible.
Right.
England wouldn't have lost that game by 1 point had Owen Farrell been on the not been on the field. They would have lost it by more.
Right. Okay. Well, I guess that totally debunks the idea that it's all about Owen Farrell haters and Owen Farrell lovers. I don't think it was a good way to go. He did play well, though. I mean, there's no denying he played. In fact, he played outstandingly well. And if Owen Farrell was on South Africa's team, South Africa would have won by a lot more. But the fact of the matter is, when it got to the big occasion, like, I know it's a cliche, but international rugby is a game of just the most fine margins. When you're this close to each other, you need to be perfect. And he wasn't perfect. He wasn't perfect. And he's the captain. And it was a thing that he can... If you drop the ball, okay, fine, skill error. But for a personality error to do you, a leadership error to do you when you're the captain, I don't know what to tell you. He can't affect the referee.
I don't understand is how it resulted in a penalty from that, because he's the captain of the team. Well, like, I don't understand. If he can't speak to the referee, because he didn't shout at the ref, he spoke to the referee and got penalised for it. He's the captain of the team.
He needs to work it out.
Yeah, it's with hindsight, you can say he should have done something differently. I think it's tough to actually say what he should have done differently, because exactly as you say, Tim, the captain should be allowed to talk to the referee. Yeah.
I mean,
and Reinach, the penalty in both instances should have gone against Reinach, because the only parameter that Ben O'Keefe set for giving the penalty, Reinach was the only one who breached it on both occasions.
Do you think there is an argument to say, don't shoot the messenger, just posing the question, that Owen Farrell could have built a better overall relationship with Ben O'Keefe? And if he had, Ben O'Keefe would have listened to him more.
You could make that argument.
Make that argument, but then you can make the argument. Could you argue that if Freddie Stewart kicked that last kick long, not short, then England would have won the game? Could you argue that if Jamie George had just dried the ball a little bit more, dried his hands before he threw the ball when it slipped out of his hands, then England would have won? It's a pointless exercise. The bigger point is England never looked like scoring a try, and that's why they lost the game.
Well, that and also Owen Farrell's descent, which led to a penalty. So,
How about another one? England don't have good enough props. I'm not having you making this about Owen Farrell, mate.
Of course
I know
you're
you
not.
Hate him, but there's so many points of failure. What is the point in being hung up on one?
I'm just making the point that was a catastrophic failure of leadership there. That's the only point that they're making.
I think catastrophic failure of leadership.
That's a ridiculous way to characterise what happened. It's a 1-point loss. That's all I'm saying.
Let's move on from that, because we've just touched on there what probably was the biggest deciding factor between the two teams.
England's props are poor.
Hang on a minute.
Well, yeah, not their props.
No, I'm talking about the nation of England. Our pool of props is poor.
Yeah, so hold this thought for 1 second. As I understood it, right, and this might just be the decline of one player. I mean, I'm assuming you would agree with this. But was it not the case that England lost the World Cup final because Sinclair didn't play in it and Cole came off the bench? That's kind of the narrative, isn't it?
Yeah, but
that's the narrative. It's not really. If you look at the game again, it's not really what happened. Dan Cole was the scapegoat when he actually didn't have a bad game in that World Cup final.
And I think there's other differences as well. So Mako was kept on too long as a not ideal. He's not as good a scrummaging looser as Marler.
Yeah.
And you had, if you remember, the second row was Big Courts and Marrow. So it was two loose head locks with a non-scrummaging loose head. Mm. So I think if you look at that narrative, the Sinclair Cole narrative, it's too small.
I can't come to any other conclusion that other than the fact that Kyle Sinclair has declined drastically as a player from the last World Cup.
I'm not even sure he's ever been that good a scrummager.
Well, he was okay. I mean, he was okay.
Yeah, okay is not great against the best scrum in the world.
He was developing. I think that's a problem with Kyle Sinclair. We had him on this trajectory when he was good enough. Did he start for the Lions? I think he did.
He played. I don't think he started in any of the big tests. I remember he came off the bench a couple of times because he almost lost his head coming off the bench in 2017.
He gave away a penalty. Did he not?
Ty Furlong would have been the starting tight head, assuming he was fit for all of those.
In 17? That's six years ago.
So you got
I'm just trying to think.
I'm sure he started against the All Blacks in the third test. Oh, maybe not. Maybe he came off the... Anyway, the point I'm trying to make is you've got this young lad, and props are players that develop late. So you've got a young lad who's already an England international. He carries like an absolute monster. His scrimmaging was getting slowly better and better at Harlequins. He goes to Bristol. I don't think he's been the same player. I don't think he's been close to the same player. And the way he got manhandled, I don't think that would have happened four years ago. I really don't. I'm not saying he wins those scrums. I'm not saying he prevents every other penalty. And I'm not saying all the penalties were his fault in this situation because one of them was down to Genge. But he's not the player that he was.
I think a couple of them were given as down to Genge. I think you might be right, but the honest answer is we don't know because 4 years ago he didn't play against South Africa.
No, he did.
And the other thing I would say that maybe counters that is the fact that Oxenche did exactly this to Radio Wardy last week.
Oh, my word.
Yeah.
Oh, no, he wouldn't have. He'd have done it to Aldegheri. Because Wardy would be on the
side.
Yeah,
Wardy's the loose head, isn't
he? Oh, correct. Yeah, sorry, Aldegheri, the tight head. So Aldegheri, it doesn't get bested by many people, and he got absolutely annihilated by Oxenche.
Smashed.
So maybe it's just that Oxenche is that good rather than anyone is that bad. Maybe South Africa are just so good in the prop area. I think George Martin's selection was with scrummaging in mind because the props, Joe Marler has talked before about how much, even though he's the same weight as Ollie Chessum, how much more George Martin seems to give to the props.
Just back to the Oxenche point you make, this is why I do not subscribe to the idea, which was sort of making the rounds last night, which was, oh, Oxenche's boring in, or Oxenche's not straight, or, I mean, Conn was mentioned it. No, Oxenche is legitimately a monster. And the reason I say that is because he did it last week against Aldegheri. And that's not an accident.
Yeah.
This guy is legit.
I think, from what I've seen, he might be the best scrummaging prop in the world. Probably is the best scrummaging prop.
Yeah, and in fact, I think he might have done it to Weenie Antonio and then Aldegheri last week.
Wow. I mean, that's quite a CV, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's quite a CV.
And that was the difference, wasn't it? That was the game right there.
Well, I think the big difference was not the actual scrummaging itself.
It's the effect that has on... It's the same at amateur level right up to the top level. You know the impact, as Phil talked about on the podcast midweek when we were looking ahead to this, just the fear of knowing that a knock-on leads to a scrum, which could be an automatic penalty, and just changes everything about the way you play.
Well, and also, as you mentioned before, Ben O'Keefe probably did lose his head. And when he's lost his head and when he's not entirely sure what is going on, which is completely understandable with the magnitude of the game, although not acceptable, he's going to give penalties to the scrum, which last looked like it was dominant.
Yeah.
And that's how you conceded that last penalty. You know, the damage was done
completely
in the other scrums. It wasn't that scrum where, you know, I'm not sure that was a penalty, actually.
Well,
I mean, someone did something. Maybe a reset would have been fair, but...
This is my other point about Ben O'Keefe's reality. And I think Ben O'Keefe was overall good in the game.
Mm.
But I think these two incidents, he got it wrong. And he spoke with such certainty about something that didn't happen.
That's exactly what you ought to do.
So, yeah.
I know all about this.
This is where, in my world, you get, if you speak with certainty and you're wrong, you get held to a higher standard. So his reason for the last scrum, for the penalty, was white loose head, went to the knee. But Genge never went to the knee.
Did he not?
No, they should.
No, hang on. Didn't the assistant call that, though?
No, because he was on Genji's side. He was on Genji and Vincent Cox's side, and Genge never went to the knee. So when they showed, because we couldn't see it from our side, when they showed it from the reverse angle, I think both sides were boring in. The whole thing shunted across by several metres, but he described an incident. His version of reality wasn't reality.
I wonder what he saw. I wonder, because you don't just say that. You don't just say he went to the knee. He must have seen something. Flanker's knee, a second row. He saw something.
Something's happened. But if we just go back, I think there was four or maybe five previous scrums since Ox came on.
Yeah.
The first one was when Dan Cole was still on, and so England managed to get it away, but he absolutely destroyed Dan Cole. I don't know if anyone noticed this.
I did.
But he just folded him in half. And then Dan Cole immediately comes off. But that didn't win a penalty. Then I think there was three back-to-back penalties, including one of the ones that turned the game, which was the grubber kick through. Farrell receives the ball out of options and puts a great grubber kick through that Elliot Daly chases on Aranser, who kind of half juggles with it and then knocks it on. England scrum, just 5 metres out.
Is this the one where they all pop up?
Yeah, this glorious. Was glorious. Jamie George is the first man
and
to
Benambi,
pop up.
And Benambi is mouthing off like no one's business.
And on that one, it looked like... So that one, Jamie George is the first to pop up. It actually looked like Sinclair got himself into a really strong position, and it looked like he got the better hit on Ox. And then all of a sudden, from nowhere, Ox just powers through him, Sinks and Jamie George.
He goes underneath him, doesn't he? He sort of jacks him up. It's
when you watch
it
again, like, Sinks is in a great low body position, nice straight back, and he's starting to drive through, and Ox actually takes a step back, and his knees are too close to his chest. He looks in a horrible position, and then the power just comes on.
I wonder if there's an element of you just don't get props that good because they're so rare. You just don't get that props that good in the Premiership. I can't think of who's the best loose head in the Premiership scrummaging.
Marler,
probably. I mean, yeah, Marler's very, very good. Who else? Is there anyone who's just a scrummaging monster like Iertsa back in the day?
I think
if you're a world class loose head,
yeah, Marler's probably the best. But he's not as destructive as he's a very, very good scrummaging loose head.
Yeah,
but he's not as destructive as like no one in the world is as destructive as
no. So no. The Premiership's not got the money to get the best scrummaging loose head in, whoever that may be, whether it be South African, Welsh, anyone else. If you're moving out of your home league, you go into France. Mm. So if the best scrummaging loose head in the world is not English, he's not playing in the Premiership. That is just a fact. And therefore, you know, how do you prepare for that? It's very, very difficult.
But there was one other scrum as well. With
Ox. Is this the one where they won it completely against the head?
No. So there was that one.
You don't see that very often in international rugby.
Yeah. No, but there's one other that was interesting, which was the mark scrum.
Yeah.
So I can't remember who called for the mark. Was it LaRue?
Well, there was two, wasn't there? So
this is late on.
Mbenambi called for it. He was captain at the time.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I can't remember who took it.
So first one to be taken was Pollard, and Pollard decided to kick it, and then it gets kicked back. And I think LaRue calls it, doesn't he?
Yeah. But anyway, scrum midfield inside South Africa's 22. And on that scrum, England didn't concede a penalty. I think it might be the only one where Ox was on the pitch that England didn't concede a penalty. Now, there's something different about that scrum from all the others in the way that England packed down.
Go on.
Laws packed down behind Sinks on that scrum.
Did he really?
On all the others, it was Ben Earl. Now,
I see. Right,
that is a difference because, well, for two reasons. One, Laws is at least 10 kg heavier than Ben Earl.
Uh-huh.
And number two, Laws is used to play in second row. So the one scrum that didn't lead to a penalty.
Can I ask a stupid question? Mm. Really stupid question.
Well, you know more about scrums than I do.
It is a phenomenally stupid question.
Go on.
But you're losing scrums. You're not just losing them, you're conceding penalties, right?
Getting destroyed.
Laws does make a difference because he's a bit bigger than Ben Earl. It is a big difference. Ben Earl plays eight. You do have another enormous man on the pitch at the same time. And maybe putting him behind your struggling tight head might be a good idea.
So I was thinking exactly this. And we'll talk about Billy in a second, but it doesn't make sense to me why Billy's packing down at eight when he's 30 kilos heavier than Ben Earl.
Yeah, that might be helpful.
But on the final one, again, Ben Earl packed down behind Sinks. Laws was behind was Genge. And that, again, led to a penalty. So I was screaming at the TV, why is Laws not behind Sinks, the man who is struggling more?
I just swap around in live time as and when you see a prop struggling.
But if they swap round, they did it the scrum before that did not lead to a penalty.
Were they playing open and loose? Open and loose, open and blind.
I think they were. But that frustrated me. But why not exactly? I was also thinking, and there might be a good reason for this, but Billy is 30 kilos heavier than Ben Earl. Yeah. Like, that's got to mean something.
Has to, doesn't it? Has to do something.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't remember the last time I've seen Billy scrummage at flanker, but it's not that hard.
Yeah, surely.
It's just not that hard.
Surely. And that could have possibly been the only positive contribution that Billy could have made in that game.
Poor Billy.
Because as far as I can recall, he had three other contributions. 20-something minutes in when he was on for the blood bin for Tom Curry. He carries into zone 22.
Yeah.
Knock on. That's number one. Number two, he was the guard at the back of the mall for when Dion Fury broke that led to the Snyman try. And he, it's a little bit of a timing thing, but he stepped in precisely as Dion Fury broke and he just left a huge hole. And number three, the final carry of the game. He was the one who didn't secure the ball on the floor. He didn't have a good
game. Well, he was.
Game.
Yeah. I mean, he was a guy who probably shouldn't have gone to the World Cup. He was in a race for fitness.
Yeah.
He's been a great servant, but it's difficult to say, has he been the Billy Vunipola of old? In the same way as Sinclair has declined, Billy has declined.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's just unfortunate. He's been a great servant. And it was a terrible game for him.
And when I saw him on the team sheet, I did think, and I said this to someone at work on Friday, I'd much prefer to see Ludlam on the bench.
What does Billy weigh? About 120?
I was going to say, that's only compounded by the fact that who he replaced, because he had to replace him, and I don't think he would have replaced. Yeah. But yes. 70 minutes, I did not want to see Tom Curry going off. That man is an absolute warrior.
Explosive 130-kilogram men don't age well.
Yes, you can only remain, when you're carrying that much weight, you can only remain explosive for so long.
Now,
so that was tough.
That's the England replacements, and that was quite a conservative way to do it.
An England replacements, I don't think really anyone made the England team stronger.
No,
they didn't. Even Danny Kerr, his kicking was nowhere near as good as Alex Mitchell's. Again, I'm not pointing at, I don't think there's any use in going the reason England lost this game is this. The reason England lost this game is they weren't good enough. And that's an across the board global point. So, but Danny Kerr was not as good as Alex Mitchell. Billy Vunipola, as we just discussed, was not as good as Tom Curry. The props were not as good as the guys that started. Theo Dan didn't even play, and George Ford hardly got and Ollie Lawrence hardly got a look in.
Yeah. Agreed. None of those England replacements, finishers or whatever you want to call them, were better than the man that they replaced. It's almost the reverse for South Africa.
Who did Ollie Lawrence replace?
Manu.
Yes, he's better than him.
But Lawrence didn't do anything in the game.
No, he didn't.
But Manu didn't do anything. So like in that game...
I think as Lawrence came on, I thought that could be a difference maker. I really thought that, but it just didn't happen. Let's talk.
Lawrence on the stage, he had 8 carries for 0 meters.
Okay, let's talk about one of the most remarkable series of substitutions I've seen in an international match ever.
Yes, let's talk about that.
We haven't actually discussed that.
Since Eddie Jones 2016.
It might be bigger than that, you know.
I think it's more remarkable than that. I really do. Like Eddie Jones in 2016, he did it to Big Luth. And he did it to Tamani Harrison.
Ezekwe got it?
Ezekwe, yeah. After 25 to 30 minutes. But he just did one change.
Yeah.
He just did one change early on. This was... I'd never seen it. Never seen anything like this.
Early and almost all the lead... Well, all the leaders. The fly half, the captain, and Etzebeth.
Yeah, your scrum half.
Oh, God, yeah.
It was
ruthless the way he did it. So the second half began... Reinach's kick was a bad kick. Right, you're off.
Yeah,
and then it was. Who was the next one that went? Oh, Etzebeth
and Khaleesi in the same goal.
Yeah,
I mean, to see. I mean, it comes at Khaleesi often gets replaced. Yeah, but kind of, you know, it's your captain.
Yeah,
it's your captain. I actually think Benambi is a better captain anyway.
And Vermaelen, who's a big leader, big captain.
Oh, Christ,
as well.
Vermaelen, yeah.
Yeah.
So like, you just got rid of. You know, those players that Marnie Lebok, maybe not a leader, but he is in a leadership position, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Any one of those guys is a legitimate international captain. And they've all captained South Africa, and they all went at the same time. And the guys that replaced them, has Faf captained South Africa? Don't think so. Pollard might have.
Pollard maybe, Faf maybe once.
I mean,
a small game.
Talk about a gamble.
Yeah. But it's
with Khaleesi, they've been doing that all tournament, and that wasn't atypical. 45 minutes
all
is
of
when
them
he came off against France.
All of them, I mean, you know, if you're taking
I'm just saying the Libok after 30 was the biggest surprise. I wasn't surprised by any of the others because against France, Kalisi came off after 44.
Hang on a minute. So you're ripping up the script, right? Which is what they did. They ripped the script. Libok comes off.
Well, no, this now, is my point. I don't think they did rip on, up the script. I think Libok was, but no.
Hang on, just let me finish. Right, so.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Libok comes off. They have ripped up the script because you've got all these leaders coming off at the same time. You would expect your actual captain to stay on to steady the ship, in my opinion.
Well, that's what I'm saying. The Libok one in 30 minutes was ripping up the script, and it was really brave, and it was a recognition of probably, had they known the conditions before they named the team, they probably would have started with Andre Pollard anyway, and it was not going well. But the rest of them is not atypical. This is what I'm saying. Look back at the substitutions in the France game. Vermeulen, Kalisi came off about the same time as they did in this game. And I think it's to South Africa's credit that they have total faith in all 33 men in their squad and from game to game in the 23 from France to today. And I think it is part of the plan. I don't see those changes as ripping up the script. I see it as remarkable compared to other international teams and particularly a captain in leadership positions. But I think I take that almost more as the way that this squad operates is very, very special.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm just looking at the side by side, the changes last week. So Etzebeth didn't come off last week, but Mostert came off at 45 and Etzebeth was 45 this week.
Yeah.
So that's a similar. So they retained a bit more.
And Mostert's the better tackler out of the two of them, and I think they were doing a lot of defensive work.
Yeah, that's fair. And I think they're more worried about the France scrum than they are about the England scrum. With good reason. Therefore, they wanted Etzebeth and Snyman in the second row against France, whereas they could continue to have Mostert this week. Kalisi last week, 46 minutes. This week, 50 minutes.
Yeah, they mentioned that in comms, the Kalisi thing.
Yeah, but Niche was 3 minutes earlier this week. Mal Herb was 8 minutes earlier this week. Vermeulen was 1 minute earlier, although he came back on because Peter Steph de Toy got a head injury last week. So it's, and then De Klerk and Reinert was, so it's actually, yeah, looking at it side by side, Libok was 14 minutes earlier. Everything else was broadly the same. Like it really is.
So do you think, here's a question for you, do you think that the sliding doors moment of South Africa's World Cup is Malcolm Marks getting injured?
It's an interesting one. Maybe they would have just won things more comfortably and not had to have one point.
But they don't have Pollard.
Yes, good point.
So
well, someone else, no, because Mpimpi got injured after that and Pollard would have just come back in.
Who did they bring in for Mpimpi? I thought he got injured before.
Lucanio Am.
Well, is Am in the squad, is he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they've got a couple of handy centres in Esterhazen and Am, who are just not playing.
Good Lord.
No, the backups. So I think even if Marks doesn't get injured and Mpimpi doesn't get injured and no one gets injured, someone gets told that they're injured.
Yeah,
like someone is out of that squad to get Pollard in.
Wow. Wow.
Yes. I've got, and I know in WhatsApp we were having some good banter earlier, actually. It was quite good fun. But I honestly have no sour grapes about the result, and I have no residual disappointment. I was absolutely crushed at full time last night in the stadium. And
the word you used was content, yes. And I don't think you mean that, Tim. I think you mean a different word.
I'm content that. Well, I think it's easier to lose when you've given everything.
I don't know.
I feel like I would have rather had a 30-point hiding than what we had last night.
I know what you mean. And it was at like 60. I remember vividly. It was at 67 minutes, and I said to Alfie, the chap who sat next to me, I said, 5 minutes. We just need 5 minutes to keep the game. If we can keep this is a two-score game for 4-5 minutes. We're in, and 1 minute. 1 minute later, try. It was they went down that end. Oh, that's one thing that doesn't get enough credit. Like the kick from halfway to actually win it, but the touch kick from Pollard to get within five was outstanding.
Yeah. We should mention that actually, because both teams had 100% kicking rate, which like neither side missed a kick. There were some bloody tough kicks that you just mentioned. Those two from Pollard. There's some bloody tough ones for Farrell as well, and the drop goal from Farrell was unbelievable.
It was that very drop good. Goal.
But yeah, I'm with you, Tim. I felt sick at full time, but I don't really. And I've kind of gone a bit heavy on the Ben O'Keefe those two moments. I thought, other than those, I thought he had a good game overall.
Yeah,
I thought he let things go on broadly correctly. There was a few iffy decisions, but they were consistent on both sides. And the scrums were very hard. And exactly what you said before, yeah. JB, that if South Africa are dominant for five scrums leading up to the final one, you can't really blame him for giving them penalty.
Absolutely,
yeah. South Africa's 100%.
Favour. I think that's a brilliant way of characterising it, rather than the stills that you're seeing online of...
I hate those stills.
Forward and stuff. I hate that stuff. I think that is the best way to look at it, the way you've characterised it. And the other thing I would say, and this is a slight smugness and also irritation, is I was in the stadium when, and there were a lot of French fans actually in the stadium, and I think I got it wrong about the England fans booing Owen Farrell in Marseille. I'm sure some did, but it was very clear that it was French fans that were booing Owen Farrell.
And me, in my living room.
Yeah, it was French fans that booed Eben Etzebeth because they were obviously still raging about what they claim was a knock-on. Yeah. And by the way, World Rugby somehow leaking to L'Équipe, or L'Équipe getting hold of some kind of communications which said, yeah, Ben O'Keefe got this decision wrong and this decision wrong.
Outrageous.
That's awful. It's absolutely shocking because, I mean... So the French public and the French World Cup has been brilliant. Some of the fans that have attended the stadium and some have just been outrageous. The way they booed Eben Etzebeth, they booed Owen Farrell, and the boo that Ben O'Keefe got was I haven't heard a boo that loud ever in a rugby stadium.
Just
ever.
Let me stop you there a second, Tim, because I'm going to link a few things together. Just very quickly, Benambi's racial slur. I want to link that to something else.
I have no idea.
Alleged. We don't know. England haven't lodged any official complaint. It was apparently heard by some people on a ref mic, and journalists followed up and asked questions about it. No one wanted to comment on it. So at this point, it could amount to absolutely nothing.
It also got picked up with Ben Curry asking the ref as well.
It did.
Tom.
Yeah.
So that was Tom
Curry.
Yeah. So. I mean, I would just point out this, which is...
No, that was the bit that got picked up on ref mic.
Yes, yeah, not the actual words.
Yes.
I would like to point out this, right? I genuinely have zero problem with it. Zero problem with it. And this is my line of thinking. If something slips out your mouth, no matter how offensive it is, and you're playing a game of rugby, and your intention is to hurt each other, because let's be honest, their intention is to hurt each other. Like, if you gave Ben Curry a clean shot on Benambi, legally, and he could hurt him as much as he could, do you think he would take it?
100%.
100%, right? He is trying to smash him. They are trying to do grave physical damage to each other at all times. And to say that they're not, I mean, it doesn't mean they want to ruin each other's lives. It's just part of the game, right? That's just how tempers flare, things are said. And that is very, very different, isn't it, to if in the pregame, Benambi said, I really hate white people. Or I really, you know, it's just a different, it's an order of magnitude different. You know, things slip out of people's mouths. And by the way, this goes both ways. And this goes for basically all slurs on a rugby field. Unless you can give me proof that in their actual life, this is how they feel. You know, it's like if you got into a fight on the street and you happen to say something homophobic or racist in your fight, even though it had nothing to do with that thing, it would be classed as a hate crime, even though it had nothing to do with that. And that's kind of where I am here. So
I hear what you're saying, JB. I struggle to, and I understand you would draw a distinction, but I do struggle to hear that point and then think back on the conversation we had about Owen Farrell talking to Ben O'Keefe.
Go on.
Well, like in one case, you're like he should have built a better relationship and should have communicated better. And then on the other hand, you can't control what you say on a rugby field.
I am utterly and utterly consistent with saying that Owen Farrell should not use racial slurs against the referee. I have never said anything different, right?
And I'm it's fine if you wanted to use one on a South African player.
he's not wrestling. He's not wrestling Ben O'Keefe to the ground, is he?
But I don't particularly want to go there until we know if this is even a thing which any player wants to actually raise as an actual allegation rather than just conjecture.
Right. Very good. Here is the thing, though, right? Rugby has got its morals so mixed up at the moment. So mixed up. And I put this sort of emphasis on language over actions. I want to look at this idea of language over actions. World Rugby, right, are far more afraid of what, say, someone like Israel Folau will say rather than the actual damage that Gareth Thomas did, right? And they'll have their picture taken with Gareth Thomas, like the CEO of World Rugby did in this very World Cup, and they invite him into studios and everything else. If Benambi gets done for this, I just don't like it. I think all this stuff which happens on the rugby field should stay there. Now, the final thing which I was going to say is that I do believe that this World Cup, one of the things we can finally put to rest is the idea of rugby values, quote-unquote. So you've had this, you've had the booing of Ben O'Keefe, you've had numerous occasions of dissent to ref, and I'm not talking about Owen Farrell here. I'm talking about, no, actually, he's not the worst, far from it. The way Dan Bigger has spoken to the ref, the way...
He wasn't even the captain.
Yeah, exactly. The way, was it, maybe it was someone in the Ireland game, who was the other one? Someone else's. Well, it might have been Benambi, actually.
In the Ireland game, you had the Ireland All Blacks game.
You got all that carry on
after. The carry on afterwards.
Did you have some carry on in this one afterwards? I don't think there
was. Vili LaRue was. I mean, like, I don't want it to come across as like sour grapes. I would congratulate South Africa. They won the game, but Vili LaRue was a bit of a dick after the game.
Seen this. I've seen there was a scuffle end.
He didn't just celebrate by punching the air. He celebrated by like goading England players a little bit.
The emphasis is always
just a bit of a dick move.
Yeah, the emphasis should always be on the winner to be graceful.
Yeah,
absolutely always. And you know, don't be a sore loser, but more importantly, don't be a sore winner. And New Zealand did it.
New Zealand,
who pride themselves on not being dickheads, turns out they're all dickheads. But you know, I'd much rather that. Ireland turned out to be a bunch of whinging morons. Even the legendary and godlike Anton DuPont had a whinge about the ref.
You know, that was worse than anything, really, because he was a captain and he went after the game, heat of battle, he then went in on a ref.
Yeah.
Like, no.
But you add all these things together. Can we just get rid of the idea of rugby values per se and embrace it for what it is, which is a gladiatorial combat sport? So just, and they should hate each other.
Just on the rugby values, I think you'll like this.
Yes, please.
JB, it's an email, contactheadchasers@gmail.com, from... Martinus Jansi van Vuren.
Oh, I read this one.
You can imagine where his allegiances lie.
Yes.
And he says, greeting experts, love the pod, love the YouTube channel, blah. He says, I was raised to hate the English. Which is always...
Where's he from? Scotland?
Which is always a good introduction to our emails. I'm a white Afrikaner, and the basis for that hate is the Boer War. Uh-huh. War crimes, scorch earth during that war.
Did he fight in it?
But perhaps slightly before his time.
I hate the French because I'm still angry about the Napoleonic Wars.
Exactly.
Yeah. Don't you get me on those Normans.
Also, Toby Flood pushing Percy Montgomery into
that
camera.
That is an outrage, actually. No, that is legitimate.
2007 Rugby World Cup final.
But fair.
But last night I let go of that anger. The hate in me evaporated when I saw the post-match interview with Owen Farrell. The embodiment of all my hate. I can see a man holding back tears, a general forced to surrender to save his troops and spare the lives of his enemies he would have slaughtered in his eventual defeat. A bigger man was not present on that field, and for that he earned my respect, nay, my adoration.
Well, well, well.
The game was an absolute nightmare to watch. After 15 minutes, I could not shake a Brighton Miracles version 2 feeling.
Hang on a minute. Is it?
Is which that... is which is a bit of of it's an offence to England comparing them to
Japan.
Japan.
Can I just can I ask? Just check that email. It's not from Tim, is it?
But it's, yeah, it's titled Martinus Jansi von Veren, but the email comes from Tim at cockamedia.com.
Weird. How does that happen?
That is weird. He has massive respect for this England team, their coach, and above all, their general.
Send.
Thanks for the memories. Okay, can Martinez.
I just finished. I must get there's a taverna with my food's getting cold at the taverna down the road, so I'm going to have to go shortly. But no, I will just say there was that. Yes, you're right. What I will say is you're right that on the it's gladiatorial combat on a field, and any rugby values is a bonus. It shouldn't be this all-encompassing virtue that we then say we're better than football because of.
That's exactly where you should put it.
But what I will say is that there was what I have seen in France, and you see at any rugby ground, is the fans generally when the game's done and everyone goes to the bar, it's still the rugby values exist there without any question. Yeah. Not on social media, and not from the players, but from the fans 100%.
Fantastic. Right, you go and have your.
I enjoyed that, boys. Thank you very much.
Yes,
no problem, and thanks for letting me get on.
Cheers, Cocker.
All right, mate. See you later.
One final thing, because that just reminded me. Mm-hmm. Saying it was a nightmare to watch. So, I was going to watch this with you, JB, but I got reminded that I had to babysit for my brother-in-law, sister-in-law. Mm-hmm. So I watched this on my own, in an unfamiliar surrounding, and I'm not drinking at the moment.
Neither am I.
But before, so I was having just a bit of small talk with them, just as they were leaving out the door and I was switching the game on to watch it. And they said, are you going to have a drink? I said, oh, no, I'm not drinking. And they said, oh, what happens if England win? Would you not even like have one to celebrate? I was like, no. But you know why I might have to have one would be if my nerves are so shot, if my adrenaline is so high.
Are you aware this is a bad sign?
At 80 minutes, I might have like a little whiskey to help me get to sleep afterwards, which I know is a bad.
It's a bad sign, that, Phil.
So anyway, brother-in-law put some Lafargue on the side in the kitchen. Oof. For me for after 80 minutes. 20 minutes into the game, I was like, stress up to my eyeballs. I looked at my watch. My heart rate was 106.
No!
Watching the game 20 minutes in, and I managed to last another 5 minutes before going for a double Lafargue. So I...
How much did you have in the end?
I had probably three doubles throughout the game.
Six shots of whiskey?
Six measures of whiskey.
Nothing like drinking on your own, is there?
Oh, God. When they came back, so they were like, oh, we heard the result, commiserations. And they were like, what's happened in the lounge? I was like, I might have had some nervous energy. So their lounge was...
So you've trashed your brother-in-law's lounge?
No, their lounge was absolutely spotless. Like, every cushion in the right place, everything.
Oh, you're that kind of drunk?
Well, I'm in someone else's house.
I'm trying to work out what... Like, you punched holes in the wall? No. He's restored the paintings.
And there was an enormous... basically a tower of Lego in one corner of the room that was about 4 foot high.
That's hide behind something.
I had so much nervous energy. It was horrible.
I didn't have any of that.
No, because...
I watched it in stoic silence.
Well, you had no dog in the fight.
I actually managed to get a load of work done during it.
Really?
Yeah, I opened up a Word document and then typed up my notes for the game as I went along, like a consummate professional. Then I processed some work for, Beardmore & Co. Independent Financial Advisors, pensions, investments, insurances, and everything else. So
fantastic.
That's what I did. I got loads of work done last night to the background of rugby. And also, managed to type away.
And if there was some way to contact specifically you in Bidmore Independent Financial Advisors, how would one go about that?
One would type simply into the email address, jonathan@bidmoreifa.com.
Ah, yeah. Very interesting.
So should you need that service, that's how you access it.
Now, there was another game.
There was. Now, we were not kind to Ben O'Keefe, but I think we were fair.
I think so. A little bit of my comments were slightly flippant, although I was not the best pleased last night. But having watched it back, I think it was generally fair to both teams.
Well, I do not think this ref is fair to Argentina in one bit at all. It's Angus Gardner.
Gardner, he was referee of the year 2018, who we had the pleasure of interviewing.
And by the way, and
in 2018, when he obviously made the right call on Farrell's legitimate tackle on André Esterhazy to win the game against the Springboks then.
In person, I've got to say, I do like Angus. We shared a beer and he's a lovely bloke.
Nice guy.
However, I thought he was horrible in this game. I mean, I really thought that the refereeing decisions made almost exclusively against Argentina, handed the All Blacks the game within half an hour.
So I think it's tough to blame the referee when it's 44-6. However, there was a turning point in this game.
Yeah.
Where Argentina were attacking and there was multiple penalties, including Jordi Barrett just kind of knocking the ball. This is 20 minutes into the game. 34 minutes, because it led to the second penalty from Buffelli. But it was, I think it was 12-3 at the time. Argentina banging on the New Zealand door, and there are multiple penalties, including Jordi Barrett knocking the ball out prone on the floor.
Yeah. Now, there's another one.
Several of those should have been yellow cards.
Yes!
And that prevented... So, yellow card, Argentina score a try there. It's 10-12.
Yeah.
As it happens, they just get the three, and then... who scored just the third? New Zealand scored a third try just before half time. It was Shannon Frizzell in the left hand corner.
Yeah,
third try just before half time. And that made it, whatever it was, 17 or 19-6 at half time. And at that point, it kind of was game over. And I can't help but feel if it was 12-10 with a man in the bin for New Zealand, it does end up being a bit of a different game.
It does, doesn't it? It really does. There is a tipping point in a game, like you say there, where you just kind of think, what is the point here? The first All Blacks try, they were gifted. They just marched up the field, penalty, penalty, penalty. And then they were in the corner. The most egregious one, I mean, there were a few egregious ones. There was clearing the man out beyond the ruck. I mean, come off it. Come off it. Right? And the other one, which just drove me nuts. And I don't think, Jordi Barrett was a different one, I think. Somebody comes over a ruck and they try to go for the ball. That's completely legitimate. Well done, great. But they knock it on. They knock it on. Now, if you're coming over a ruck to try and pick it up and it's in the 5 metre zone and you knock it on, that is a yellow card. It's a penalty at least. It's beyond a knock on. That's not a normal knock on. No issues. Mm. But this happened over and over again. And then Argentina were just found... I just think that they weren't given the rub of the green in any way. It's hard for me to remember every individual instance because I don't have my phone with me with my notes on. But I remember just making voice note after voice note saying, this is outrageous. Some of the things that they're getting called up for here, which the All Blacks are not getting called up for. I mean, whether you need to be a tier one side to get the respect. Argentina are a tier one side. But whether you need to be an absolute world powerhouse to get the decisions, I don't know. But
maybe
I thought it was very, very poor refereeing.
Maybe you need to talk to the ref in a different manner. Maybe Montoya was not communicating as he should do. Maybe he's doing a bit of an Owen Farrell.
I never, ever like to go down this route. Ever, right? But there could be something to be said for referees speaking some Spanish, I guess. I mean, I hate it when anyone goes, oh, isn't it great that Wayne Barnes speaks French? Because I assume Wayne Barnes is professional enough in order not to have to do that, right? And they can sort of communicate in a certain way. Maybe there is something in it, because there's no way that Montoya, who, you know, I get reports of what this guy is like around Leicester. He is meant to be one of the most outstanding humans that anyone in Leicester has ever worked with. They love him. They call him the Emperor. They absolutely love him. Right? But if he can't get his message across for whatever reason, that is a problem. That's a massive problem. And if it is a language barrier thing, that again is a massive problem, but I don't believe it is.
Yeah, I think right, wrong, good, bad or indifference, rugby, as with aviation and pilots, have the primary language of English.
English, and that's so how it should be.
That is how you communicate. So it's not, for me, it's not on the referees. It is on the captains and the teams, whether you like that or not. But that is the situation. You'd have to change English being the language of rugby to change that situation.
I think you're right, because you do go down that ridiculous idea of Fiji versus Georgia. Who refs it?
Well, Japan. Japan have they've beaten some of the top teams. Like, does referees have to start learning Japanese?
Well, they just speak to Michael Leach. Yeah, but yeah, you are
when,
right.
Yeah, when Leach...
Probably that is why Michael Leach is the captain.
Yeah. And now, Japan probably won't struggle because they've got any number of Aussies, Kiwis and Saffas lining up to play for them.
Yeah.
And indeed, Pacific Islanders. But that's... Yeah, I don't think you can blame
the ref. It is actually a much bigger problem, isn't it, for the South American countries than it is for the... Like the Japanese.
Well, because I think all of Argentina's players were born in Argentina.
Yeah, same with Chile, same with... Where was it?
And,
Uruguay.
I don't know if you know this, but England, they're not the favourite nation in Argentina.
What?
I don't think too many people were rushing to learn English in Argentina.
Well, I mean, they've got a spy on those signals somehow.
Well, that's true. In the end, if I was a bit disappointed, because I think there were some unusual decisions, and a failure to give a yellow card to New Zealand in that first half was bad. I don't think it would have mattered in the end.
I don't think the end result would have mattered, but it would have made a much better spectacle.
Yeah, you know, I agree.
I am firmly of the opinion that the future of rugby is in France and South America. You know, I don't think there's much left of the rest of the world, and if there is, it's declining. I think the only
Portugal and Spain. I think that they are two legitimate markets for growth.
Yeah, it's basically Spanish-speaking nations, right? And I don't know why this is. Hang on, let me put it a different way. It's not that there's nothing left in the existing nations, but they're not growing, they're stagnating. So where you're going to find your growth is from the Spanish-speaking nations. That's what I mean. That's where the game has got the potential to get bigger.
I tend to agree. Spanish and Portuguese-speaking nations. Because Brazil as well.
Yeah.
Would be like some fantastic scrimmaging from a few years ago from that Brazil team.
There was actually, wasn't there?
Yeah.
So like, because this was such a washout for a semi-final, if it was a close game or whatnot, I think that bodes much better for Argentina and, you know, all the Spanish-speaking nations, really.
Definitely, yeah. If it was a close game, 100%. Yeah. Now, I just want to talk about... I've seen a few things on Twitter and...
I've not seen any Twitter at all.
Sensible. There are some people like using this as... ammunition to say the whole draw is a joke. Now, the draw is suboptimal from some angles, but to use this result as the ammunition to say the whole draw is a joke is a bit weird, because to do that, you have to ignore the fact that... So we've had now 6 knockout games,
yep.
5 of which have been absolute dynamite. 5 of which have been like some of the best knockout games and closest knockout games we've ever seen.
Yeah. Just on that one, actually, one thing I wanted to ask Tim and you is, like, you didn't actually mention the quality of the England game.
Because I was too nervous. I thought some of the skills in the air were superb. Some of the kicking from both sides, but I thought England got the better overall, was superb. Some of the hits, the multiple hits by... George Martin, just multiple, several by Tom Curry. Elliot Daly nailed Dwayne Vermeulen.
Yes, he did.
And he also nailed, I think it was Aransi, which is easier to do because he weighs about 40
somewhat
kilos less.
Easier, yeah. Yeah, somewhat easier.
And so there were some superb elements to that game, of combative elements. I mean, if you look at the stats, if... meters made was the primary stat you were looking for. The Argentina-New Zealand game was over 1,000, and it's 500 versus 600 in New Zealand's favour. So both teams made a lot of meters with ball in hand. England was 230 versus 190. So barely over 400 metres total. But that's just looking at one narrow parameter.
Yeah, like it means nothing to me.
Yeah. You can have great games with lots of metres made. You can have some fantastic games without.
Yeah. Well, I guess back to your point, like, is this the game to knock? I mean, the draw, some optimal, yeah, but you can't necessarily make, you know, you can't doctor a competition so close that you get the perfect draw. It's always going to be suboptimal. But you're right, France versus South Africa, one of the greatest games of all time.
Ireland versus All Blacks.
One of the greatest games of all time. I mean, like, yeah. You've got, like three games. Ireland versus South Africa was... I mean, that was... This World Cup has really thrown up some of the all-time classics. There's never been a World Cup with this many classic games.
And
then the England game.
That's my kind of... So everyone's... To argue that the draw is rubbish because of this one game, you have to ignore, like, half a dozen... Like, truly amazing games.
Yeah.
Like, some of the all-time brilliant games.
And we've still got one more to go.
Which you only would have got in the semi-final in a per... So you would have had, in kind of three good games, if everything goes well, in a perfect world.
Yeah.
But this, you've had them right throughout the tournament, including four last weekend and an all-time classic this weekend, and multiple in the group stages.
Yeah.
So...
I mean, those games I've mentioned, I mean, I'm not just saying they were good games. They are truly... excellent games.
Yeah, yeah. Like the two 8 PMs last weekend in the quarters, they are legitimately two of the best games of all time. Two of the best games I've ever witnessed.
Yep, agree with that. Maybe England game didn't quite match those. In some ways,
it was a hell of a game, though.
Some ways it did.
Yeah, it might not have had all the skill set in terms of the running and the distribution, but it didn't need it because it had the stories, it had the physical battles, it had the confrontation. And it had the heartbreak at the end.
Yep. Anyway, so, I mean, I don't know what you want to say about the Argentina game. Maybe Tim was right. There's not much to say.
Will Jordan's quite handy.
He's all right. I mean, yeah. I could finish with the All Blacks.
You say that for the first two. The third one.
I think I switched off, but...
The third one is from his own 22.
Yeah, I got to 60 minutes, I think, and I thought, oh, I forget this. I'm just getting angry.
So he had two relative walk-ins, even though you've got to be in the right place, and one of them he popped up on the opposite wing just at the right time.
Yeah, but would you blame me if I only got two tries in a World Cup semi? I mean, you wouldn't really go to town on me, would you? Just two tries in a World Cup.
No, but the third one, like if you
I can, don't need
you,
it.
You can say that. I guess that kind of proves the point. You, as an above-average level 7 winger and highly above-average level 7 tight head prop...
Thank you.
..could score two of those tries. Sadly, the third one, you're not scoring. I'm not sure how many people in world rugby score that third one.
I need to look
from
at
his
this.
Own
I've,
22.
I've not actually seen it.
Yeah.
The All Blacks are very interesting going into this last game because I still don't think they're a great team. I think their pack is underpowered, but...
You know, that's the problem.
The talent in the backs is as good as it's ever been. Maybe they're not the best back line, but the talent is...
Yeah, because you made this point about the all-time best All Blacks centre partnership is Manu Onu and Conrad Smith.
Yeah.
But in terms of the physicality, the acceleration, the pace...
Skill set.
The overall skill set, Ioane and Barrett, they can do more.
Oh, much more. I don't think there's a pair in the world ever. who's a better pairing?
Hard to think. I mean, the current French pairing are phenomenal.
Who's the 13?
Fiku. Dante.
Ooh,
and Fiku.
Yeah.
But they've not reached the World Cup final.
Yeah, and Dante is a very unique player. But he can't do what... I mean, likewise, Barrett cannot do what Dante does.
No.
Dante cannot do what Barrett does.
Yeah, that's a hell of a centre partnership. But yeah, you're right. And Diolande and Lucano Am on their day were phenomenal as well.
That is true. I just don't think that there's anyone... I don't think there's any pair of centres which was well-rounded as these two, physically and skill-wise.
Yeah, I tend to agree. But I don't think... So my head now for this game, we'll touch on it briefly, I'm sure we'll do a midweek preview pod. My head for this game is, how long can New Zealand have scrum parity and how far ahead can they get with that scrum parity? Because when Ox comes on, when the bomb squad comes on... And that is, I'm sure I saw the official South African announcement, and they called the bench the bomb squad.
Oh, the whole bench is not the bomb squad, is it?
Yeah, they're on their official announcement.
Hate this. Substitutes.
I hate it as well. Like, England had finishers for a period of time.
Yeah.
Harlequins had game changers for a period of time.
Concussion boys, we had that for a little while. Yeah. Get the concussion. In fact, that's exactly what New Zealand actually did use, concussion boys. Like, well, we'll be expecting changes soon in case someone gets injured. Okay.
So, yeah, now it is. Can they get parity for one at the start?
Nope.
And maybe... No. Can they for, let's say they get to parity, because South Africa, I think, are smart. I think they don't. I think they've done it. They did it to a degree against England. They did it against Scotland. Perhaps a bit against Ireland early on, but they don't go for scrum penalties early on because they show a nice picture to the referee.
Mm.
They wait for the opposition to tie it, and then when they know they can definitely, when it's not a 50-50, they know they're definitely going to get it.
It's on.
They go for it. So I think there will be some parity early on. Can New Zealand use that to get enough points to give them enough of a buffer for when they no longer have parity for 30 or so minutes, when if Ox comes on after 50 minutes again, the last 30 minutes, when they do not have parity, are they far enough ahead? I think the answer is no. But we will see.
We will see indeed. I don't think they are power. I don't think they go ahead in the game at all, really. For all the skills they've got and all the power and the pace, if that South Africa team get their defence spot on, I do not actually think that the New Zealand coaching team are going to come up with a strategy which will be smart enough to outmatch South Africa. Whereas I think the South African coaching team will come up with something.
I don't know, because South Africa didn't play particularly well against England.
No, they didn't.
They were the second best team in many facets, perhaps not all, apart from the scrum. They were light years ahead in the scrum for the last 30 minutes.
Yeah. The other thing as well about that game, and hopefully we'll see South Africa change this up a bit, it's like their backs were contained, and their backs have been electric of late. But we didn't see anything really of Ches and Colby or...
Arantse or Creel or Diolande.
They were very quiet.
None of them. 190 metres with ball in hand. Total. Of the back line, Ches and Colby made 18 metres, beat no defenders.
No defenders?
Arantse made 24 metres, beat two defenders. Valemse, 27 metres, beat two defenders. Creel didn't run a single time with ball in hand. Diolande made 9 metres. The whole back line didn't make 100 metres with ball in hand.
It'll be interesting. That New Zealand defence was mighty impressive against Argentina.
But it's a different beast.
Yeah. I mean, they had ref assistance, they had everything else. You, if you're refing these two, it's going to be very hard to be biased. Now, there's a horrible reality to this. The treatment of Nick Berry, which was horrific, and I think we've all roundly condemned this, it is like a warning shot to other referees. This is what will happen to you.
Well, so in 2021, do you know who was the referee that followed Nick Berry for the second test in the Lions Tour?
No.
Ben O'Keefe.
Who was it?
The man who has refereed the quarterfinal and the semi-final for South Africa.
Ooh.
I mean, I just don't think that's a particularly good look for World Rugby, making that appointment twice on the bounce after 2021. Have you listened to, with Ross Tucker, John Dobson, the Stormers head coach?
No, I haven't.
About 4 weeks. He's really worth listening to.
Okay.
Really, really worth listening to. Because he talks about the Stormers, like, he talks about scrummaging and says they spend 20 million rand, I think he said 20 million rand, X million rand, 20 million
rand. 20 million rand. What's the exchange rate? It's like
1 million pounds. Yeah, 1 million pounds on three players in their front row. In Kitsy, Dweber and Mal Herb. And if referees aren't giving them scrum penalties, well, that's 20 million rand wasted.
It's so true.
But he, in that, says he has no doubt that that Lions tour, the second and third test, were won by the Razzie Erasmus video.
Really?
And he's a South African director of rugby. And I do wonder if its effects are still being felt today.
Without doubt.
And we looked at that game and the one after, the second test in the Lions, it took well over 2 hours to complete that game.
So interesting, isn't it?
This game took nearly 2 hours to complete.
I look at the world as it is now, and one of my pet hates is basically institutions, companies, whatever it is, who operate not for the benefit of their consumers or their shareholders, but for other tangential interests, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. The easiest thing in the world for South Africa to do when Razzie got done for that ref thing, which I thought was sackable, actually. I mean, I would say that because I thought his behaviour was disgusting.
Yeah, so if I put a South African rugby hat on, I do not sack him.
However, with
World Rugby, I would think I might have been calling for a much longer ban at the time.
Yeah.
And I think it's probably right to do so.
So for South African rugby to sort of keep him in place, because actually their goal is to win rugby.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, that is the right...
It's
not nice. It's not nice for everyone else, but if that is what you're meant to be doing.
And this is... If you're a South African, if you want South Africa to win, you will rightly, because your incentives are aligned, you will rightly love Razzie Erasmus.
Yeah.
And love the fact that he did that.
He's a dickhead, but he's our dickhead.
Dickhead, and lots of teams have those players, like the Welsh love Dan Biggar.
Yeah.
The English, for the longest time, loved Mike Brown.
Dan Biggar is legitimately one of the nicest humans in the world off a rugby pitch.
Yeah, yeah. And we know lots of people who, when they're on the rugby pitch, are totally different animals.
When I see him on the field, he makes my eyes pop. It's like, what are you saying?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
How are you behaving?
And that's, we judge Razzie, and when we kind of flippantly say he's a dickhead, we judge him for the rugby content, not the other stuff, although... Some of his drunken dad dancing is a bit of a
awful
dickhead play. But we judge him for that because we're not on his side.
Yeah.
If you're on his side, you would absolutely love him.
This does have a hangover, but so does the almighty power of the New Zealand Union. I just don't think Argentina have that sort of power. So if you're the ref in this game, I think you've got to call it down the middle. You've got to do that. No one from the Argentina Union is keeping any refs up at night.
And I think the refs do all 100, they call it down the middle as they see it, but I do think sometimes other factors can possibly get on top of them.
Mm, true.
Even like other factors that are legitimate factors, like we said, if you've conceded 4 scrum penalties in the last 20 minutes and there's one that's 50-50, it's not going to go your way.
Exactly.
And that was one of the things that cost England that game.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no one, what does Kahneman call it, the availability heuristic?
Don't know what that is.
You've read Thinking Fast and Slow, haven't you?
I have the book. Does that count?
Close enough.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
I have read it, yes.
You're
Sorry.
Influenced by the most available, like you always think of, easy to think of examples.
Yes.
And that skews your viewpoint.
And I've also read him, he features in another book, doesn't he?
Sorry, it's not Thinking of Fast and Slow. It's The Undoing Project,
which is
the Michael Lewis.
Michael Lewis, yes, because is he the professor from Israel?
Yes,
that's the one.
Kahneman and Daniel Kahneman and Avos Tversky.
Yeah, they do write Thinking Slow and Fast.
Yeah, yeah.
That so is their book, but it features in the.
It's Kahneman's book.
Yes.
Yes, not Amos's book, but yes, it's the principle from both is. Or one of the many principles is the availability heuristic.
I actually preferred the story about his tank battles. That was a bit which interested me about Amos.
They were pretty cool.
Yeah, so. Right, I think if we talk about Israeli tank battles, I think we're probably done.
Do we want to talk about any of the Premiership stuff?
No, I think we should say...
Save it for another time.
We need to come back to this, so we need to come back and maybe do a midweek domestic podcast.
Yes.
Because there's a lot of stuff been going on.
There's a lot of stuff, not least of which the 2021-2022 salary cap report came out last week.
Did it? Not least of which, a team's gone under this week.
Have they?
Worcester Women. Now, that doesn't sound like a big deal, But when, quote unquote, the women's game is thriving, leaving the Premier 15s with only 9 teams is maybe not the best idea. And I've heard another one is on the brink. Someone will be pulling out soon.
Sad, not entirely surprising.
Well, it's okay. They're going to invest 220 million over 10 years. Why don't they just bring some of that 220 million forward and save? What's that? No? What have I missed? There's 220 million somewhere.
There is. Yeah. It's going to get spent somehow.
It has to.
It's going to get talked about.
Yes, exactly. There'll be £220 million worth of PR, probably. Right, that's enough. You can find us on all the major podcast providers because we are the oldest and best rugby podcast. You can contact us on contactdeadchasers@gmail.com. Don't bother with other platforms. They're not worth it. And I think that's it. So we'll see you hopefully for midweek domestic podcast from Tim, who says goodbye, and me and Phil, who also say goodbye. Goodbye.
Let the boys end.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com. Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.